did it again, didn't you? You know, you're flying down the road in a 3-ton hunk of steel, and a text takes your eyes off the road for an average of 5 seconds. At 55 miles per hour, that's long enough to travel the length of a football field and cause some serious damage. Turn it off. Trust me, whatever it is, you'll live. Learn more at StopTextsStopWrecks.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. KPFT Houston.
Thursday, and time for So What's Your Story? The only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, and it's right here on listener-sponsored KPFT Houston. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Edgerton. Gotta tell you, you could call me The Edge, you can call me Dr. Mary, you can call me Dr. E, okay? And along with an ensemble of gifted hosts, we have Dr. Hank Rubicek, our show's founder. We have Greg Audell and Floyd the Wonder Dog. And I sometimes wonder if it's actually Floyd the Wonder Dog appearing with guest host Greg Audell. And Dr. Warren Holloman, our master of wellness, whom, I might add, just celebrated a birthday. In the control room, we have our engineer, media director, and sometimes our guest host, Tatiana Gago. Together, we celebrate the power of story by bringing you storytellers to tell us their own stories live here on the radio. These are the people who take us on journeys through the windows of their souls with moving narratives, either real experiences or magical folk tales. My guest tonight is Dr. Rich Johnston, Associate Professor of English and Fine Arts at the United States Air Force Academy, affectionately known as USAFA. In addition to his responsibilities as a USAFA faculty member, he is a short story fiction writer, and in this last year was nominated for a Pushcart Prize. Go, Rich! Rich and I are both Marshall Scholars, a few years apart, and he is in town for our annual selection process for the 2020 Marshall Scholars. Stay posted. Those will be announced in several newspapers when we have finalized them. My listeners out there may remember Rich, as he has been my guest every October, going on 3 years now. Today's our third anniversary.
It's good to be back. Thanks, Mary.
I love it, Rich. I love it when you're in town. So the other day, Rich and I were talking, and we hit upon a topic for tonight that we both love. Collections. It turns out that we're both collectors. Now, you may think that a collector just collects stuff, and they don't keep it under control, and then they become hoarders. And I tell you, I have a lot of relatives who would be happy to say that I am a hoarder, but I am a collector. And you will find out from our stories how to tease apart one from the other and what it really means to be a collector. And for those people that don't collect, that don't know, that call us hoarders, disbelievers, heretics. Collections are something very special. They mean something.
They really do, Mary. I mean, I think that
I don't know. I mean, for me, the phrase sentimental value really sums it up. And the problem is that people who collect, people who see the sentimental value in things around them in their life, they can't really communicate with people who don't have that gift. When collectors and non-collectors attempt to get together, just all kinds of problems can emerge.
Yes, because a collection is a tangible reminder of a memory. It's a tangible thing that you hold on to that contains the memory. And then people who only work in the non-tangible world, I don't think they get it.
They don't, but it's not usually a problem until the collector and the non-collector are forced together or until they begin to cohabitate. I learned this very recently when I bought a house and moved in with my wife, Nicole, my partner of 18 months now. I'm a collector. She's not a collector. And this became a problem, Mary. It became a problem. Let me just rattle off a few of the kinds of collections that I have. I have a collection of mini shampoos and conditioners and hotel amenities from hotels and motels that, I don't know, that have just a little bit of sentimental value. The Red Carpet Inn in Quantico, Virginia, a $29 a night hotel where my mom and I stayed on a particularly memorable drive from South Carolina to Boston back in 2005. Collection of Piggly Wiggly t-shirts from my 20s and 30s. A collection of records and LPs. Maybe we'll say more about those later. The remnants of my childhood baseball card collection. A collection of consecrated bottles. And what I mean by that, Mary, I mean wine and whiskey bottles that have a special sentimental value for me. The bottle of old Laphroaig whiskey that my father gave me when I got my first job, my first real job.
Yes.
And with the bottles that meant the most to me, I would decide to consecrate that. And what that meant was I would take a candle from Target or Walmart or something like that and shave off the bottom and basically turn it into a nice candle holder. The problem was when Cole and I moved in together and started merging our possessions. I mean, I must have had 30, 40 of these candles, and honestly, some of them I couldn't remember where I'd gotten them. All I knew is that they had sentimental value. It was pure crust, pure foam, just total sentimental value covered in wax. They were a fire hazard in this old house that we bought together. They were a health hazard for her birds. She has three birds whose names are Dante, Copernicus, and Baby Bok Choy. And, you know, you can't be burning candles, standard candles around birds.
They can't handle smoke.
With their little nostrils and their little tiny lungs, no. So the bottles had to go. And, I mean, it was hard. It was rough. Now, the T-shirts, you know, they made it for about 2 years. But, you know, if you can imagine, you know, our closet where we shared our space. I mean, there's Nicole's clothing, and Nicole dresses like a mature person, an adult. And then there are my hoodies, my Piggly Wiggly T-shirts. I must have had 2 dozen of them. I had every color under the rainbow. I had tie-dye. I had camouflage. And it wasn't until Nicole pointed out that the logo, the Piggly, you know what Piggly Wiggly
is,
right?
Absolutely. We had a Piggly Wiggly. Where do you think I learned how to eat ice cream every day? It was hot. Mom would say, if you're good, I'll take you to the Piggly Wiggly with me and you can get a popsicle.
Well, some of my fondest memories of childhood are anchored in the Piggly Wiggly, and thus this collection of shirts. And I couldn't give them up. They made it for 2 years. And finally, you know, Nicole pointed out a kind of uncanny resemblance between the pig, the logo, and my kind of boyish round face. But anyway, so we came to an agreement. I would give her the T-shirts, and she is going to make them into a quilt, one of those T-shirt quilts you hear about. I don't know when. It'll probably be 15 or 20 years before I get this quilt. That's just a guess. But now, those were a problem, but the real problem, Mary, were the books. We are both English professors, and we both have a lot of books, and we move in together, and we had completely different ways of organizing our book collections. I organize all of my books alphabetically. It doesn't matter the genre. It doesn't matter if it's poetry or science. If I know who the author is, that's where it goes. And Nicole had a different system that was like partly like the beauty of the book and partly like the genre of the book. And this was just like there was a battle. And there was no good way of combining our collections. And I mean, even now, that there's one shelf in our house, one shelf with books, and I can tell every time Nicole passes it, she looks at it and she scowls at it because there are a couple of her favorite books next to science fiction writers that I kind of admired when I was 19, and I know she hates it. I know she hates it aesthetically, and I know she wants to get rid of it. And well, we're just at a stranglehold.
Books are the final frontier in any relationship.
Well, and it's doubly, I think it's doubly hard for Nicole to live with me because the thing is, a collection can start with me at any time. I'm almost 43 years old. We've only been married 16 months and 8 days. I don't have a lot of stuff that has sentimental value attached to our relationship. And so I'm constantly, I feel like I need to catch up, Mary, that I need to start
introducing her into the collections.
Building collections about her.
Yeah.
We both love the water. We love living in Colorado, but we miss the water so much. And so we're starting to collect seashells together. We've started collecting oyster shells. And it's getting to the point where if I have a really good oyster at a restaurant, I want to take it home. And sometimes I leave it in the back of people's cars, and this causes problems. Rocks. But, I mean, where does it end? I mean, I go to this baseball game last night, the Astros and the Nationals, and I get this orange towel, and I have this orange towel right here. When I was a child, I wanted to be a baseball player. I'm 42. I've never been to a World Series game before. This was an incredible experience, Mary. We experienced it together.
We did.
And I have this orange towel, and this has incredible sentimental value, and it has to go in a prominent place in my home, but I don't know where it's going to go. I mean, look at it.
You have some ongoing tensions in your story there.
We do.
I have to say I'm really drawn to the books part.
Mm.
Because when I married, my husband and I both came to the marriage with our separate book collections. Like you, we both loved books. Now, I think we had a little easier time merging them. But somewhere in our marriage, he strayed. He was having affairs. I discovered it. And I'll never forget that night. Because when I found out, I went to him and we were talking. And I said, well, we have two avenues here. We can go to a marital therapist and work on this. Or we can get divorced. And he said, I don't know. I have to think about this. And I have to consult people. I have to ask my sister what she thinks. And I have to ask my aunt what she thinks. His mother had passed away. And I thought to myself, I don't have to ask anybody. And if you're not leaving this woman tonight, I'm leaving you. And I didn't say that. But I suddenly, out of my trauma, my heart racing, my inability to sleep, it was probably 1 o'clock in the morning, I now had a new purpose in life. I was going to unmerge our book collections because our marriage was going to unmerge. And I went to the bookshelves.
You went for the books.
I went for the books. And I began to pull out his books and put them to the side. And this created holes. And more of his books, and took them to the side. I went to our little tchotchka collections, you know, little trinkets and whatnot, and pushed his over to one side and mine to another.
Mm.
Everything I was separating. And And it gave me a sense of calmness. But he became very distressed as he saw this going on. Now these holes in the bookshelf, the unmerging of our collections. And he said to me, "What's going on?" And I said, "We're getting divorced." And he just looked around. He walked around for a little while. And he came back and he said, "Okay, I'll tell her it's over."
That is one of the saddest stories I've ever heard. Mary, I mean, that the image of those holes, those spaces where books used to be in a merged collection, that's heart-rending.
And I didn't realize until we were talking about this, what the merging of the collections means when two people come together and they merge their collections. And that night, something inside of me just intuitively understood, okay, I'm getting out. I need to unmerge. And he intuitively understood that this was a reality happening by the symbolism. And you want to know something?
What?
We stayed together another 10 years. It was such a powerful statement on merging our collections that we stayed together another 10 years.
I had a hard time listening to that story. I don't think I'm ever leaving Nicole. I don't think Nicole, no. That would be unbearable.
I mean, after you've merged these, how can you unmerge them?
No.
The importance of your collections, the extension of yourself, your memories, your microcosms of your experiences, collections are just such an important part of yourself.
Well, they're not just an important part of you. They connect you with other people. I mean, my baseball card collection, it connected me to my father. My father's coins connected him to his father. The oyster shells connect me with Nicole. The music collection, the vinyl collection, connects him to my sister.
Oh, I found my father's stamp collection, which connects me to his childhood. And then his drawings of books, and I'm a bird watcher, as you know, you're a bird watcher. And I realized his interest in birds. But there are these people who think that because we collect, we're hoarders. I mean, there are members of my family who just roll their eyes when they see something and I say, "Oh, look what I've been collecting." And they think I'm a hoarder.
Well, I went to... So I'm in Houston for a couple of days, and today I went to the Museum of Natural History and Science, and it won't surprise you or anyone that I love museums, because all museums are
collections.
And so I go to the special exhibit that I had read about online somewhere called Death by Natural Causes. It's this incredible... Have you seen it, Mary?
I haven't. I have read about it, though.
It's an incredible...
I mean, being a pathologist, I'm fascinated, and I do need to see it.
Well, it's this collection of things from all around the world that can kill you, whether these are Japanese hornets or things in your own household, like houseplants that you don't know might kill you if you ate them, or, I don't know, medicines that they used to give people 100... Oh, here, you're sick, have some mercury, right?
Right.
And I was looking at a display, and it identified different types of phobias, fears that can induce panic attacks and have been known to lead to cardiac arrest. And some of them I was familiar with: arachnophobia, fear of spiders, brontophobia, fear of thunder or loud noises. But then the last one, Mary, was disposophobia. Disposophobia. It's a fear of throwing things away.
I think it runs
AKA
in my family.
Hoarding.
I think it runs in my family.
You come from hoarders?
I come from hoarders, and I'll tell you a story. And this story, I think, really helps you to distinguish hoarders from collectors. My father loved to read the newspaper, and he loved to read it in bed. And he had left a small company of petroleum engineers and gone down to our hometown to ranch. It took years to build up the fences and build up the herd. So he was able to sleep late while my mother took us to school. And he would read the newspaper in bed. And he would say to us,
Winston Churchill read the newspaper in bed for years, and he lived to be in his 90s, and he was prime minister twice, you know. So we, of course, thought this was, like, the thing to do. Well, on Sundays came our Sunday Corpus Christi caller, and he would be reading it. He wouldn't have finished it by Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and he wasn't ready to let it go. So I haven't finished reading it. So our job as children, somewhere around Wednesday or Thursday, maybe a little before the next Sunday, maybe as late as Saturday, was to take and gather the Sunday paper from last week and take it down to what we called the back bedroom. It's just a back room in the house that used to be a bedroom. This is like one of those, what, 12 by 15 bedrooms, 12 by 12. And we would take it, paper, and put it in there. I have to tell you, this went on for years. Years. And my mother would say, George, all those Sunday papers. And he would say, Sue, you have to admit that I am the most well-informed man you know. And that would end the conversation. Until one day that 12 by 15 room...
caught on fire?
It could have at any moment. It was filled from floor to ceiling, out bursting through the door. And I think behind closed doors she said to him, George... it's me or the newspapers. Take your choice. Mm. And so he decided that we could take a trip to the dump. Now, being from a family of hoarders, we did not take very many trips to the dump because we had nothing to dump because we kept it hoarded. So this actually took many trips.
Well, I can see where this is going. I mean, dumps for hoarders are pretty dangerous places.
This is because... we would pile up the back of the truck with newspapers, and those were the days, don't do this, don't do this, I don't advise this. But in a small town in the 1960s, all the kids would then just jump in on the back, sit on the newspapers, make a space for themselves, and we'd have six or seven neighborhood kids riding in the back of the truck going out to the dump, throwing out the newspapers. But here's my dad in a hoarder's heaven. Wire. Pipes. Cans! Oh my God, I'm surprised we didn't refill
the truck.
The truck. I do believe he threw a few things in that we brought back, but there was just this whole magic of the dump. But this was my introduction to, you know, maybe there's something not quite right with that, and not everybody keeps their Sunday papers for 5 to 10 years stacked up in their room. So, yep, that was hoarding. That was hoarding. But I don't know, you know, when you start out and you're collecting and you don't throw it away, and like I say, I have relatives who say, you know, Mary, you come from a family of hoarders, you know, you got that little collection. How do you know you have a collection and you're not, you don't have, what do you call it, disposophobia. How do you know? How did you know?
Well, I think... okay, I knew when I bought my first vinyl LP, my first record. This would have been in the fall, I think, of 2007. Now, I have to give you a little bit of a backstory. When I was growing up, my sister, Julie, she lives in New York now. She was a huge Bob Dylan fan. I am too, but Julie...
nothing wrong with that.
Julie came to Bob Dylan long before I did. I was in high school... my first girlfriend was a violin player, so I was listening to classical music, and I don't know, I was just a big snob. I didn't think that Bob Dylan or any of the other artists that she was listening to were all that valuable. And until one night, I got into a fight with my dad over dinner. We started talking about politics or something like that, and I told my father that if we went to war with the Soviet Union, I was going to go to Canada, and my father dismissed me from the dinner table. And a little while later, my sister Julie comes into my room, and I can remember her coming in with her little purple jam box, and she says, "I want to play you something." And she plays for me this song by Bob Dylan called "Masters of War." And I was hooked. And at that moment, and it brought us together, I started listening to all the Bob Dylan I could. And flash forward, among Dylanophiles, like a prized possession is something called the Great White Wonder. This is actually the first rock the first important rock bootleg album. There were bootlegs for blues and jazz before The Great White Wonder, but in 1969 there weren't really rock bootlegs until a small company in California released this album, later dubbed The Great White Wonder, that contained songs by Dylan recorded in Minnesota 8 years earlier. 1961, a tape later released as the Minnesota Hotel tape, outtakes from his earlier album, recordings from the Johnny Cash show, recordings that he did with the band in 1967 in upstate New York. We had seen this album together in a record shop in New York City. And I was a college student. Julie was a high school student. We couldn't afford it. It was like $150 or something like that. But then a few years later, again, the fall of 2005, I see this record at a basement bargain price in some used goods store in Boston, and I bought it. I bought it with the intention of giving it to her, but before I gave it to her, a friend of mine said, "You really need to listen to it before you give it to her." And I said, "Well, I don't have a record player." And he said, "Well, I have two here. Have one of mine." And so he gives me the record player, and I set it up, connect it to my stereo. And even before I started playing it, I knew that I was hooked. I mean, you have the album. You have this giant object, and you don't press a button to find the song that you want to listen to. You have to find it with the needle. Inside the record, there was a hand-typed list of songs made by the fan who had owned the record previously. The name of the fan written in ballpoint pen on the inside of the album. I was hooked, and I realized that I ended up not giving the record to my sister, by the way. I kept it for myself. But I realized with $20, you can go into a record store and exit with treasure. And it's not just collecting records. It's exploring entirely new niches or ecosystems of music.
You're in a whole new... You've transformed from one physical space, one paradigm to another.
And not just music. I mean, I bought up all the Bob Dylan that I could, all of the Shakespeare on vinyl, every recording I could find of Brahms' Second Piano Concerto, musicals that I used to love. But, I mean, the things that you could find in this record store, in the 40s and 50s, Mary, people used to take recording equipment and just set it up somewhere. They would set it up in a train station in Chicago, or they would set it up on a train and just hit play, hit record, and would record it traveling from one station to another. And for 46 minutes or 45 minutes, you're listening to the sounds of people walking to get their shoes shined in Chicago, or passengers in a dining car who were pulling into a station in Denver. It was incredible. It's like discovering a new planet and new forms of life. And then, like I said earlier, little ecosystems in those planets. And
so collections take you to another ecosystem. Collections take you into an ecosystem.
Into a different ecosystem, into a time.
Yeah. And that's different from hoarding, where you can't throw it away. A collection has this somehow physical instantiation of a memory, a feeling, an ecosystem. And it's amazing. So that's how you started collecting vinyls.
I did.
And you entered the ecosystem with Bob Dylan.
And you know, and some of the hardest Bob Dylan records to find were the ones that these acoustic albums, Good As I've Been to You and World Gone Wrong, that came out in the early 80s when Dylan was sort of at the bottom of his popularity. And about five years ago for the holidays, my sister found a copy of World Gone Wrong and gave it to me, which completed my Bob Dylan collection.
Right. And it's the you were buying for her, and then you became the collector, mm-hmm. the believer, and then she was buying for you. That's an amazing revelation about collectors that I think the naysayers need to... Well, that too. that too. I mean, when you have a collector item, how can you let it go? I have more to say about that. I have a special collection I want to tell y'all about, but it is the middle of the hour, and so I need to tell y'all a few things along the lines of station identification. So hold tight. First off, I am Mary Edgerton, your host tonight on So What's Your Story, our award-winning radio show with my guest, Rich Johnson, telling stories about collections, which are not stuff that hoarders keep. Okay, make that point. We here at the show are broadcast live every Thursday at 8 p.m. here at our KPFT station in Houston. You can hear us on your radio at home, also available at FM 89.5 in Galveston and 91.9 in Huntsville. And don't ever forget, if you don't have a radio and you don't want to go sit in your car and run that engine, just dial your computer to www.kpft.org and listen to us live streaming over the internet. I do want to thank all our donors for the last few weeks. When we were in the fund drive, thank you so much for donating. And to those of you who listed our show as a special one to credit your donation with, a very big thank you. Our show is so important to the community because stories not only connect the storyteller to the people close to us, they also connect us across the community. And I want to say that there are collectors out there who are feeling heard and loved and respected.
And validated.
And validated with these stories. And that there are people who are non-collectors who are hearing this and saying, I think I understand. I think I get it.
Well said.
Thank
well
you.
Well said, Mary.
Thank you. Okay. Well, Tatiana, hearing your wonderful voice, can you tell us about some storytelling connections in our community?
But of course. Let's start with our sponsor, the Houston Storytellers Guild. Because, you know, it's a great place to learn about the art of telling. They meet the fourth Tuesday of every month from 7 to 8:30 p.m. at Temple Emanuel, and that's located at 1500 Sunset. The prerequisite for a great Halloween begins on Saturday, October 26th, when the Guild hosts one of their storied events, Skyline Screamers. This Fear for Free event will spotlight some of Houston's best storytellers. It starts at 7 p.m. just when it turns dark at Marmion Park, located at 18th and Heights Boulevard. Be sure to visit the Guild's website at www.houstonstorytellers.org for information about all of their upcoming events, including Telebration, the international day to celebrate storytelling held at the Black Lab of Montrose on Saturday, November 23rd. And while you're on the Guild's page, why not become a member? It's easy to do online. Also, to listen to some of our past So What's Your Story programs. Every show since 2008, all listed on the menu under radio program. And if you don't own a radio, that's not a problem, because you can listen to us stream live on kpft.org and on Facebook Live. We're also on YouTube and also on Instagram. I guess you can say we're all over the place. And why not suggest program ideas by visiting our So What's Your Story Facebook page and share it with your friends. We'd love it if you like us when you leave. Got guests to suggest? Maybe yourself? Let us know by dropping us a note at story@kpft.org. And we promise to get back to you. And don't forget our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live, the second Tuesday of the month, where you'll enjoy some terrific stories. Next one is November 12th, and the theme is gratitude.
Well, so hey, Tatiana, and what's up next week on So What's Your Story?
Well, next week at 8 p.m. falls the night of Halloween itself. So Dr. Hank will be here to bring you tales from the crypt to celebrate Halloween.
Oh, I got to tell you, I'm a scaredy cat. I saw Psycho, and I, for 2 weeks, I slept with the radio on and the light on. Be careful, Hank. But let's get back.
Mother! Mother!
Ah, no, don't do that. Getting back to collections, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about one of my collections that I started when I was in England. We were both Marshall Scholars. We both studied in England. And here in the U.S., I grew up in this tiny little town. There wasn't even a movie theater, much less any stage theater nearby. And I went to college. I saw a few college productions. I was fascinated by the concept. And I arrive in England. And for £6, which was at the time about $10 in the 1970s, you could get a seat at a theater in London and see anybody. I mean, you could see Julie Harris, anybody, anything. And so I went to several plays and I started saving my playbills. They were a remembrance of this whole new world that I had entered, of being able to access theater. And I saved these playbills. And of course, there were people who were like, seriously, playbills? And seriously, I shipped boxes of playbills from England back to the United States. And then as I moved. Now, I moved back to the U.S. And there was one particular play. And this is going to be your story within the story. My story is about my collection of playbills. But within the story is another story. Because I found out that there was this production of Macbeth with Peter O'Toole. An incredible actor. And I thought, I have to see this.
You saw Peter O'Toole on stage.
I saw Peter O'Toole on stage as Macbeth. Now, there's a whole drama of how I got there, which is another story. But I got there, and I open up the playbill. And this is how rich a playbill is. I mean, you could think that a playbill is going to tell you something about the biography of actors at a point in time.
Right.
And maybe later those actors became famous and you can say, oh, look, here's a timestamp of where they were then. And there are the places to eat and the advertisements of what's going on. But these playbills would also have a little history of the play. And I found out that Macbeth was associated with doom and gloom and bad omens.
Actors don't call it Macbeth. Actors refer to it as the Scottish tragedy. Apparently it's bad luck just to say the word inside the confines of a theater.
And the most wonderful story, the playbook mentioned several, but the most wonderful one was Laurence Olivier's story about playing Macbeth during the Depression in England. And during the Depression, nobody would go to see the theater. They were either too poor or too depressed. I mean, people just didn't go to the theater except for what they called in England the old age pensioners, the OAPs. If you ever go over there, there's these signs, seats for OAPs only. Those are old age pensioners. So the OAPs would go in because they only had to pay a small amount and they would be able to stay warm inside the theater. They weren't working. And so Laurence Olivier says, every day we came out and there were five or six OAPs huddled together sleeping in the theater and we acted out Macbeth. One day, a 15-year-old boy came and was sitting down in the front row. And the actors were so inspired that they began to play Macbeth to him, their best production of Macbeth. It was incredible. They were just energized by this. And the actors went back at the end of the first act, and they were in the back in the dressing rooms, and they said, this boy will never forget this experience. This is wonderful. And they came back out again to start it again, and the boy was gone.
Oh, my heart just skipped a beat. That's incredible.
I know. And so, yeah, Macbeth is a curse. Macbeth is a curse. I would never have known this story had I not collected
my playbills.
And so I kept these playbills, and let me tell you, I moved them from Norwich to San Francisco, and San Francisco to Stony Brook, and Stony Brook to Manhattan, and Manhattan to Plainfield, New Jersey, and Plainfield, New Jersey to Kingsbrook, New Jersey, and then on to West Trenton, and, well, many places. My friends have all scratched out. They said, you've used up the E's in our address books, when we used to have address books. And I found my playbills in a box the other day, and I was thinking, well, what am I going to do with these now? And I mentioned them to my oldest daughter, and I said, you know, I found my playbills, and I have playbills of Peter O'Toole, I have playbills of Elizabeth Taylor, I have a playbill of the actual original Dreamgirls on stage. And she said, that's it, I get them, they're mine.
Don't, whatever you do, Mom, do not throw them away.
Do not throw them away. So I'd like to think that I'm crystallizing the collector gene and pushing back on the hoarder gene, and the playbills are a collection.
Well, you're also, you know, establishing something you're creating a relationship with your
to enter that ecosystem of a playbill. It is an ecosystem.
I can hear your daughter's voice. When I was growing up, one of the horror stories that my father used to tell me was about how, when he was in college, my grandmother threw away his collection of baseball cards from the 50s and from the 60s. And I, growing up, I collected baseball cards, and hearing, just imagining the Mickey Mantle cards that might have gotten thrown away, the Hank Aaron cards, the Willie Mays cards. Oh, it was just, I would go up into my grandmother's attic looking in boxes, just hoping that maybe I would find somewhere a shoebox that had some of these cards that my father had collected that maybe had, that the Reaper hadn't gotten, but no.
So did you collect baseball cards?
Oh, I did. I mean, for as long as I can remember, I got an allowance, I think, of $2 a week when I was in the first grade, and I would take that to Ford's drugstore on Main Street and buy, you know, 4 or 5 wax packs of baseball cards. I collected these cards obsessively. I dreamt of being a baseball player. A couple of my prized possessions were the rookie card of the Dale Murphy, who used to play center fielder for the Atlanta Braves in the 80s and early 90s. A rookie card. So there was Dale Murphy's rookie card. There was also a card of Dale Murphy that I drew myself, of Dale Murphy, sent to him, which he signed and sent back to me. And he was wonderful about this. He would always interact with fans, sign autographs before games. I met him once at a spring training game, and he signed that card and sent it back to me. And Mary, I don't know where that is, and it just kills me that I have lost that little piece of memorabilia. I tell you what, though, this will give you a sense of my childhood obsession with baseball. I do have this letter here. When Nicole and I moved in together, she found in the back of one of my books this letter. It was a letter that I had written to myself for a school project in September of 1988. So I guess I would have been just shy of 12 years old then. And here's the envelope, and it's addressed to myself. It says, "Do not open until September 12th, 1988. And well, we looked at it together, and can I read it?
I
think it'll tell you a lot about me. It goes like this on the first page. "Dear Richard, we just won our 107th game of the season. We have only lost 18 games. I went 6-for-7 with 5 home runs and 18 RBIs. I tripled also, making it my 50th straight game with an extra base hit. I broke Joe DiMaggio's record today with a 57-game hitting streak. So far this year, I'm batting .575 with 90 home runs and 196 RBIs. This reminds me of my childhood days. After my 9 years of baseball in Atlanta, in an Atlanta uniform, I am batting .400 with 800 home runs and 2620 RBIs. I have 8 world records already, with 8 MVPs and, of course, 8 gold gloves, 8 triple crowns, 8 all-star games, 8 World Series rings, and a Rookie of the Year, which you can only get once, I guess. I have even pitched in 60 games this year with a 36-2 record, with 407 strikeouts and a 0.05 ERA.
That's an incredible
ERA.
I
have a good chance at the Cy Young Award this year. I also make $6 million a year, plus about $1,000 extra in prize money. I also have $5 million in baseball cards. I love my life. I have 2 kids, Harry Jr., that's my father's name, Harry and Richard. They both like to play football. They love the Falcons. I bought them season tickets." You turn the page, and it continues. "I am married to a famous lady umpire who makes $100,000 a year.
Okay, there were no lady umpires back then. You were an early feminist.
I was. Well, in March of that year, Pam Postema became the first woman to umpire a Major League Baseball spring training game. I think that must have been what I was writing out about. But yeah, I was a feminist. I didn't just support them being umpires. I married one. And it notes here, she makes $100,000 a year, and she fixes the best peanut butter sandwiches. I have an awesome neighbor, Andy Lancaster, who is a famous golfer. His kids are so nice. They help retrieve my baseballs in my backyard when I have batting practice. I am lucky enough to have a good life. Even going to Harvard, I have a 200 IQ. Then in parentheses, it says E equals MC squared. I did well in baseball there also. I was so famous. I won 5 Mercedes. I don't know what that means. That's probably a recruiting violation. Well, got to go to batting practice by, misspelled by, B-Y. And then it ends with a quotation. So I'm speaking, come on, Harry and Richard. Andy, get them kids over here for their paycheck. Honey, get my 6,000 baseballs, my cage, and my pitching machine. Thank you. Love, Richard J. And then at the bottom in the far left corner, there's a picture of my rookie card, a picture of me, signed by me, and a little note that says that this card is valued at $10,000, and signed, it's valued at $25,000.
So you made a rookie card for yourself.
This is my rookie card right here. Mm-hmm. In a nice profile, 1986 style. Never worked out, though. Never became a baseball player.
Oh, but that's wonderful. That came out of your collection and the whole world you were living in. You know, you were living in the baseball world because of your collection.
I was.
You know, your collection and your tickets and your everything. But so did you actually play baseball?
No. Well, I wasn't very good. I kind of gradually learned that, and I have a story. I'd like to read if I could.
Okay.
It's a story. It's a three-part story that I published in Hobart, an online magazine edited by Aaron Birch. Every year they do a baseball issue in April, or they'll do a series of stories or poems or essays about baseball. And 2 years ago, I published a three-part series of short pieces entitled Balls and Strikes about my childhood obsession with baseball, and particularly my childhood obsession with becoming an umpire when I realized that becoming a baseball player wasn't probably going to happen. And so I thought I might just read the first of those stories.
Oh, let's go for it.
Well, so the subtitle of this one is Not About Astronauts.
This goes with the Astros.
One. My earliest memory is rubbing neat's foot oil into the pocket of a baseball glove. When I turned 8, my dad gave me a wax box of Topps cards. I opened all 36 packs at once and nearly choked to death on the gum. And when I shook hands over a chain-link fence with Dale Murphy after an exhibition game between the Braves and their minor league affiliate in Greenville, my love for the game was complete. I would sneak downstairs at night to watch away games against the Dodgers, the Giants, and those oddly brown and yellow-colored Padres. I'd draw diamonds in the margins of my homework and stadiums on the back. I'd design logos and uniforms, both home and away, for places that didn't have teams yet, cities like Charleston, Las Vegas, Anchorage. Then I'd group those teams into leagues and divisions, draw up complete 162-game seasons, and play all the games myself with a pair of 12-sided dice saved from some board games my parents had confiscated because they had read somewhere it was connected with devil worship. I played baseball, too. Real baseball, of course, and I was pretty good until I got to junior high school. My first year in coach's pitch, I batted a perfect 1,000, if he counted, as I did, the errors as hits. In one game, I had a grand slam that knocked out a right fielder on the neighboring t-ball field. To supplement my pitiful allowance of $2.50 a week, I drew baseball cards of myself and sold them to my grandmother and all her nursing home friends. By the age of 10, however, my dreams of becoming a professional baseball player were beginning to fade. My first year in fast pitch, I struck out 5 times in one game against my best friend Bert, who played for the Dr. Robin Ivy Chiropractic Yankees. The 5th time, I slammed my bat into the dirt and said something awful, and the umpire, who couldn't have been more than 16 and sported a giant red mullet, ejected me from the game. This was far worse than the spankings both my parents gave me that night. Those only inflicted physical pain. Reflecting in bed, hungry, on what the ump had said and the sign he'd made with his arms, I thought of the picture in my illustrated Bible of God pointing Adam and Eve the way out of paradise. 2. My friends lived for bottle rockets and Boy Scout merit badges. I, however, lived for called third strikes. I didn't even care if the Murph struck out, so long as the opposing pitcher caught him looking. When that would happen, I'd rise to my feet, fill my lungs, and finish him off, because an umpire can have no heroes. My weapon of choice was a chainsaw. I've never held a real one and have no desire to. How absurd that must feel, using a chainsaw on a dead tree branch or something when you spent practically your entire childhood cutting down professional ball players stunned by a nasty slider. There are many different versions. My standard one went like this. I would stand up solemnly, turn my whole body toward whichever dugout the dying batter had come from, and lean slightly toward it with an outstretched fist. Then I'd reach my other arm parallel to the first. Finally, I'd glance to the heavens, take a step backwards, and yank my arm violently across my chest as though I were pulling the machine's tight chain. All this would be accompanied by a guttural howl that sounded vaguely like strike and out. It was a sound I imagined ancient priests making when ripping out the entrails of sacrificial bulls. The chainsaw was my favorite weapon, but I didn't always use it, especially on the easy calls. An ugly curve that nicks the outside corner of the plate is a thing altogether different from a fastball that splits it in half. In the latter case, a touch of mercy was required, so I'd just stand up and, taking a small step backwards with my left foot, punch the air in front of me with my fist. That's actually a technique I learned from basketball, my other favorite sport. I grew up during the golden age of the NBA slam dunk contest, when Michael Jordan, Dominique Wilkins, and Spud Webb were kings. But as much as I liked a good windmill or double pump and was always practicing them on the 6-foot goal on the first grade playground, what I really loved was when someone, in my mind, it's always a player for Duke, would get a breakaway on a turnover and kind of sprint, saunter down the court and make as if to dunk, but then, at the last possible moment, just drop the ball into the net like it was no big thing. That's the image that comes into my mind whenever I hear the word finesse. But I never had an interest in becoming a basketball ref. All that running, all that blowing of whistles, and all those fouls in the last 2 minutes of every remotely interesting game, it's plain undignified. That and the heads of the refs themselves, which are always unnaturally shiny. 3. What separates a home plate umpire from all other officials in all other sports is his mask. And this is important because when I was growing up, it meant you couldn't see their faces. This was in the 80s, when the picture quality on even the latest and most expensive sets, like the one Bert's family had that weighed 500 pounds and required 4 men to move, was so poor that a game played on AstroTurf and received over the air looked almost exactly like something played on the Nintendo. It wasn't a man behind the plate calling the balls and strikes and punching batters out. It was a god, maybe even a goddess. The March 14, 1988 issue of Sports Illustrated featured Pam Postema, the first woman to work an MLB spring training game. That cover had an effect on me more electrifying than all my grandmother's back issues of Cosmopolitan combined. There's a story I remember from Sunday school. Maybe it was the mythology unit in 8th grade English, about a man who wanted to see a god's face. I mean, really see it, without any filters or fleshy disguise. God warned the guy, but he didn't heed his warning, and so God showed him his everlasting face, and the sad son of a bitch was blasted from existence. When I was a kid, I'd think about that poor guy, for I could get it, you know, wanting to see God's face. Whenever I saw a player or his manager start to argue a call, I'd sit paralyzed in front of the TV. If the ump took his mask off, you knew what was coming. You knew how it was going to end, with a weary toss of the hand toward the abyss of space somewhere out beyond one of the foul poles. Even today, when I read in a book about Jupiter or Zeus gathering a thunderbolt to strike some mortal with, I think of Paul Runge or Jerry Crawford ejecting Chuck Tanner from a game against the Astros at the end of another of the Braves' hapless, deplorable 90-plus lost seasons. 4. I think that's how it began, and why an umpire on TV can still put me into a trance. Whenever I would watch a game, and that was often, seeing as how, even without cable, we got both WGN and TBS, I'd drag a rocking chair across a rug and place it right in front of me, right in front of the set, so I could squat behind it, just like a real ump does, with one hand resting lightly on the catcher's back. And I'd call the balls and strikes. The rocking chair spindles were the bars of my protective mask. "To hell with astronauts," I once told this rich kid whose dad had worked for NASA and had given my fourth grade class a motivational, patriotic speech. When I grew up, I was going to be an umpire. The end.
So everybody out there, just to let you know, Rich and I went to a World Series game last night.
We did.
We splurged.
We did. Well, we played it smart. We played what I like to call StubHub chicken. You wait until game time, and then people start getting nervous, and the prices drop, and we got lucky. We got so lucky.
Okay, it's true. It was a little bit of a nightmare in which our baseball game turned into a basketball game. But I remember turning around to you, Rich, at one point and saying, "See those umpires out there? Nobody loves them. We all boo them when they give us the call we don't want. And nobody cheers them on when they're doing the right thing."
Oh, you have to have a backbone of steel to have that job. I couldn't do it. There's no way I could do it. But that was really special last night. I mean, the World Series, you grow up watching these games. You don't ever actually imagine that you actually be at one.
Okay, we were not only there, but we saw some home runs on both sides. And the first inning
was great.
We were on that game cam.
We were on the Jumbotron.
Yes. Yes, we were.
Hank Aaron was there giving out the award. And who threw out the first pitch?
Simone Biles.
Right.
She did a flip.
A jump and a twist.
Yes.
And I didn't realize that she was from Houston.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Night. Oh, that was great. All another story. We're winding to an end. I hate to say that. Thank you, Rich, for being here.
Thank you. It's such a pleasure. It's always a pleasure.
And may all you collectors out there take heart. And may all you other people who haven't understood us think about it. We have ecosystems that we live in. But don't you dare move now, because Lars and the Tennyson Tape Deck is ready in the wings to share a very cool collection of classics with you. Make 90.1 a part of every day, and while you're driving home, turning in for the night, or just chilling, join us every Thursday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. Keep loving great stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. This is Mary E., and along with the rest of the So What's Your Story team, we never want you to forget that it's never too late to live happily ever after. Peace.
If you decided to donate your birthday to KPFT this year, thank you. If your special day hasn't yet arrived, consider donating your birthday to KPFT. Here's how it works. Facebook sends you a prompt before your birthday asking if you'd like to donate your birthday to a nonprofit. Select KPFT as your organization of choice. Then add a personalized message so that your friends know how much KPFT means to you. On your birthday, they'll receive a Facebook notification asking them to make a donation in your honor to KPFT. Thanks again for supporting 90.1 FM KPFT Houston. Pacifica Radio for Peace.